From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop, and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, September 21st through Friday, September 25th, 2020, it was a week of drama that began with the death of an iconic Supreme Court justice and ended with another police-related outburst of protest and violence in urban centers across the nation, with rising doubts about the smooth transition of presidential power mixed in along the way. Stand by, as we're about to be joined by people with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices, sharing their observations and the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation, all part of the verbal stew in which we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, an examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information is gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Okay, let's get this show on the road. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, psychology and relationships. The words you hear to describe how a growing segment of the population feels about the weight the events of 2020 are putting on their shoulders include despair, depression, frustration, fear, anger, and hate.
And as the bad news grinds on, a syndrome described as toxic stress increases, and suicide has now moved up to become the 10th leading cause of death in the United States of America.
At number 9, climate change and natural disasters. Aside from the pandemic, the number of natural disasters that continue to plague the nation include wildfires, heat waves, anomalous storms, slow-moving hurricanes, and wildly fluctuating temperature. What next? Locusts?
All of which increase the case for the reality of global climate change presenting an existential threat to humanity and the need for a concerted public and private effort to offset its negative impact, an effort that thus far has been stymied by politics.
At number 8, the education crisis. As COVID-19 continues to be contagious among all age groups, the opening of schools is not going smoothly. Many are still closed and others are struggling to open in fits and starts as kids are getting sick, blended schedules are confusing, and remote learning is not going smoothly.
According to the CDC, college reopenings appear to be fueling the recent uptick in U.S. coronavirus cases. According to new estimates, reopening colleges for in-person classes has added more than 3,000 new daily cases to the U.S. tally, and overall cases of the coronavirus have spiked dramatically among young people in their 20s.
At number 7, the economy. More bad news for the job market this past week as claims for unemployment benefits are moving in the wrong direction. Initial unemployment claims rose last week to 870,000, and the previous week's total was revised higher. A wide swath of industries, including restaurants, transportation, tourism, sports, and entertainment, are drowning in red ink as a result of the pandemic, and the rippling effects of the situation are negatively impacting a wide variety of other businesses and industries as well.
Experts from across the spectrum are calling for more stimulus from the government to keep businesses afloat as proprietors are struggling to meet their payrolls and residents unable to pay their mortgages and rent. But Congress is poised to recess until after the election without coming to a deal as the deadlock in Washington continues.
At number 6, U.S. foreign affairs. Concern continues to grow as evidence mounts that Russia, under the personal direction of Vladimir Putin, is engaging in a blatant social media disinformation campaign to disrupt the American presidential election.
And as the president continues to point out, evidence indicates China is a major culprit in the initial cause and spread of the coronavirus, not to mention the CCP's war of subversion against American interests around the world. Meantime, controversy over the Trump administration's call for a ban on the popular app TikTok remains a struggle, making headlines in the news and creating discussion in the national conversation.
At number 5, healthcare, vaccines, and masks. A number of major pharmaceutical companies around the world, including Moderna, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and Johnson & Johnson, are getting closer to finding a vaccine to combat COVID-19, with several moving as swiftly as possible to go through the phases, tests, and trials necessary to come up with a formula that will be safe as well as effective. Johnson & Johnson is reportedly already in phase 3 of its testing on a promising vaccine.
Dr. Anthony Fauci said there's growing optimism that scientists will find one or more safe and effective vaccines by the end of the year or early 2021. But he warned that it might take some time for FDA-approved inoculations for COVID-19 to become available to the public because of the rigorous clinical testing required to develop a safe and effective drug. Meantime, the highly politically motivated argument over the wearing of masks in public continues to be a day-to-day factor of life in America.
At number 4, COVID-19 statistics and projections. Clearly, the numbers have become a national obsession as we track our successes and failures in the war against COVID-19 on a daily basis. This past week has not been a good one in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, as the disease shows troubling signs of surging in yet a next wave as we get deeper into the fall months and a very difficult winter looms on the horizon.
As of the time we're producing this program on Friday, September 25th, the number of COVID-19 cases in the U.S. has swelled to 7 million, and the death toll now stands at 203,000, which is significantly more than 3 times the number of fatalities we suffered during the entire Vietnam War. Experts forecast the grim number can reach 300,000 by the end of the year.
At number 3, race relations, police reform, and the Breonna Taylor protests. The beat goes on as the latest round of protests and violence surges across the nation out of the flashpoint of Louisville, Kentucky, in the aftermath of the grand jury there not charging any of the 3 police officers involved in the wrongful fatal shooting of Breonna Taylor with murder.
This terrible incident adds yet another page in the frustrating chain of events that has increasingly polarized the nation's understanding of the balance, reasoning, and rational thinking necessary to maintain effective and just policing in our nation's increasingly troubled urban centers.
At number 2, the presidential race and the mail-in vote debate. President Trump ignited a firestorm of concern this week over his refusal to indicate whether or not he will go along with a peaceful transition of power in the event he loses the election, which, if it actually happens, would trigger a constitutional crisis that many experts believe could seriously endanger the institution of American democracy.
Meantime, because of concerns over the accuracy of mail-in voting raised to an all-time high due to COVID-19 and other obstacles to a smooth and stable electoral process, Americans are bracing for an extended period of legal battles that could postpone the results of the vote for a very dangerous number of weeks and perhaps even months after the first Tuesday in November.
And at number 1 this week, the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the resultant Supreme Court debate. As if we didn't already have enough drama in our lives, the death of the iconic Supreme Court justice, liberal warrior, and champion of women's rights so close to the election has raised a firestorm of controversy and political intrigue over the question of whether it would be fair and appropriate for the president and Republican-controlled Senate to nominate and appoint another conservative to the bench, thus influencing American jurisprudence for a generation to come, without taking into account the will of the people as it is about to be expressed in either a second term for Trump or a new Biden administration.
As I say at the end of every program, looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. Well, the death of RBG right before the most consequential presidential election of our lifetimes is an example of that process in action. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Okay, let's get some viewpoints from around the country on the hottest topics in the national conversation, beginning with one of our favorite contributors to the show, a 29-year veteran of the morning program on WPG in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and a former vice president of the Trump Hotel Organization when the current occupant of the White House was a hotel and casino mogul in America's playground. Talkers Heavy 100 radio star Harry Hurley. As we're now in the fourth year of the Trump administration, you probably filter everything that you see from that perspective of what it was like to work with him as a boss. Is that still going on in your head as you follow the news?
Every day. Michael, every day. For example, I'm probably one of the first broadcasters in America to understand and fully process and know in advance of this Saturday that President Donald Trump will nominate Amy Coney Barrett, who is currently on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, to be the next Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. All you have to do is he leaves breadcrumbs. Our president leaves breadcrumbs. He gets credit for being a liar. He's actually the most transparent. Wait until he's gone on January 20th of 2025. The media is going to miss him terribly, Michael, because the access that they're used to getting is no access. He gives them total access. So he said a day or two ago, he said that he spoke with this one, and that he said, well, will you be speaking with Barbara Lagoa when you're in Florida? And he said, I might, but I know him. So I know that that is Trump speak for that. I already have my mind made up. I know who it's going to be. She's impressive. She's on my list of five. But no, it's not going to be her. So I have I call it an interpolator when President Trump speaks, because I know what it means. And I know I'm going to be right about that. And I'm giving this to you in advance of it being formalized. And that's the kind of advantage that when you work with someone every single week, three or more days a week for more than 2 years, you know how they operate. President Trump is much more transparent than he gets credit for. And that's just one little insight to my 4 years of covering him. And I've had such an advantage, and I've enjoyed it so much.
Well, I want to tell everybody to timestamp this. This conversation was taking place at 2:45 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday, September 22nd. That is what's called a bold prediction, my friend. I at first I didn't know if you were kidding, and I also didn't know when you said on January whatever it was 20. I thought you were going to say 2021. I go, what do you know something? You know the results of the election, but you did say 2025. This is going to be very. This will be interesting to follow. What do you think about Mitt Romney coming around to the Republican side on this and announcing that he is going to go forward, which basically kind of cinches it, doesn't it, that Trump will make the nomination and it will pass before Election Day? What are your thoughts about all that?
I'm so glad you asked. 4 hours ago, I wrote a social media post, and I wrote with a nice picture of Senator Romney. I wrote that I had been tough on United States Senator Mitt Romney, and I highlighted him. And the great Matthew Harrison knows what that means. That means he's going to see it. I highlighted my president. He's going to see it. I put, today I salute him, meaning Romney. He's doing the absolute right thing. He really is a patriot. He's got hard feelings. You have the situation that President Trump emasculated him and destroyed him in the primary for president. Then he had a second emasculating experience, that infamous dinner that I don't believe was an accident, that all of it was caught, and very silly, because I don't think he was ever seriously being considered. So that was very, very, I think, tough. And I think he took that a lot harder than anybody has ever written or spoken about. But I wrote that Romney has confirmed that he will support the president. He will support the confirmation prior to Election Day. That's the biggest news. Not that Mitt Romney, a.k.a. Pierre Delecto, that's his alias, as you know, that he came out strong and fairly early. I mean, he waited. You had the usual suspects, Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins. They did what they do. They're like the no team. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to hurt Susan Collins. I think she was a bit in the Star Trek Kobayashi Maru, the no-win scenario, because if she comes right out, and of course she has to live with the Kavanaugh vote that she did, which I think was the right vote, but she's getting hit hard for that. Now she would get hit hard for this. But the votes are there, and the key is that this will take place prior to November 3rd, because to have the ninth justice seated, I think it's a foregone conclusion that they each have 1,000 attorneys already hired. Votes are going to be coming in weeks after the election. This election, we will not have finality on November 3rd. There will be a contest phase. And if the ninth justice was not seated, I have no doubt the ninth justice would have been seated before the end of this year, before December 31st. But if the case had already started, then there would have been eight justices, and Justice Roberts is a little unpredictable, so you just never know how that would have gone. It's much better if we're going to have a Biden v. Trump, which is what I think we're going to have, not Trump v. Biden. Let's see if that's another prediction on Michael's show. And that's how I see it going with a full complement of the court. This nominee has 51 votes as we speak. The Democrats will be very upset. They're threatening to pack the court like FDR tried to do. They're threatening a lot of other things. But this is over. This is checkmate. They just haven't caught up with it yet.
That's Harry Hurley, the morning show host on WPG in Atlantic City and a former vice president of the Trump Organization, sharing some personal insights into how the nation's chief executive thinks. Coming up next, a conversation with Scott Sands of WSPD in Toledo about the turbulent fallout that has followed the Breonna Taylor grand jury police decision. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap. Murder mystery fans, what do we really know about the TV reality stars we invite into our homes? Are they what they appear to be? Brent and Cammy Purdy are a blissful married couple who turn rundown houses into modern showplaces. Brent, a soft-spoken, gentle giant who can fix anything, teams with Cammy's design expertise to transform slums into penthouses. In Richard Neer's latest Riley King novel, Brilliant Disguise, he rips the facade off reality TV to reveal the truth. Is Brent really a hot-tempered monster who killed Cammy in a fit of rage? Or is Cammy a gorgeous but ruthless actress who uses him to advance her ambitious career? Brilliant Disguise by Richard Neer is available at Amazon.com in both paperback and Kindle versions. Get your copy today before you watch another minute of reality TV. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. The Kentucky Attorney General's announcement that none of the three officers involved in the shooting of Breonna Taylor would be charged with her murder has sparked a number of protests, including gun violence against police, that began in Louisville and subsequently spread to cities across the country. Joining us now to share his perspective is WSPD Toledo afternoon talk show host Scott Sands. What's your reaction, and what's the reaction of the listeners to the Breonna Taylor decision?
You know, I think the general consensus is empathetic towards law enforcement. And in this particular case, there are so many layers involved with this. And while I believe personally that the letter of the law was certainly followed in the indictment or lack of indictments in the Breonna Taylor case, that the spirit of justice certainly was not followed. But I think a majority of the responses that we're getting from listeners has been, this is an overreaction. The police did their job, and bad things sometimes happen to good people.
So is it being looked at as a racially oriented situation, or more just about police violence in general?
I think it's an issue more of just the way many people perceive this to be a police state. I think it's obviously amplified in the wake of multiple police violence incidents around the country that have involved people of color. And in that context, it certainly reflects poorly on law enforcement nationally. But again, we're dealing with such a small number of bad cops that certainly should be weeded out of the system. But you shouldn't condemn an entire system of law enforcement based on the actions of a few. In this particular case, in the Breonna Taylor case, obviously the one officer who was indicted deserved to be fired, and was fired immediately for being reckless with the discharge of his weapon. But the fact that Breonna Taylor herself, who was killed by the actions of a police officer, is not receiving what many people in the public, especially in Louisville, perceive to be justice, is certainly being talked about more and added to the fuel of fires from George Floyd and Jacob Blake and others around the country.
What are your thoughts about the general race issue? Do you think that we're going to come to a solution? Do you think that this is going to dissipate after the election? And depending on who wins the election, what impact on these on this reckoning, so to speak, do you think we will experience?
I hope for the sake of my son and future generations that races in America can come to peace. But I don't know what the solution is. There are obviously people who feel that there has been so much injustice that it will take generations to overcome. And for those of us who grew up outside of that environment, we're not sure what we can do as a generation to help move things along. But I think there are certainly amplifications of the tension for political gain, and that's a shame, really. That's tearing our country apart and dividing people. And you're seeing the vitriol on social media, and you're hearing it on talk radio, and that's not good for anyone, and that's not good for our own mental health, especially with what our country's been through the last 6 months as well. It's all coming together at the same time. And I think that's part of the reason why things are starting to boil over, whether there was an election or not. But the fact that this is an election season certainly is playing into it. And there are people on both sides who are trying to stoke those fires to meet their own agenda goals.
Are you concerned about President Trump's not answering the question about whether he will accept the verdict of the election? Do you see this as a crisis for democracy brewing?
I don't know that we'll see that. I think that a lot of what President Trump does and says is to control the narrative and honestly to drive many people in the media absolutely crazy, and he does a terrific job at that. So I don't know how much of what he says on any given day online or in a press conference to take seriously, but I certainly think that this is going to be one of the more interesting elections to watch, at least since Bush v. Gore, because we may not know the true winner of the election until days or weeks later, and that could potentially cause a constitutional crisis and one that we need to be patient and understanding. Part of that, again, brought on by the pandemic. Many people will be afraid to go to the polling places to vote in person. Don't want to catch the virus or spread the virus. Many poll workers may not turn out to work. And that's going to cause all sorts of problems in many key states on Election Day itself. And the longer it takes before we can certify a winner, the more tension there will be and perhaps more civil unrest. But I hope we as a country can just take a breath and wait to see how this plays out before we start going to state legislatures and take it to the streets, because that's, again, not going to solve the problem. In fact, it will divide us even further and perhaps drive people like President Trump towards taking other actions that the president may not have otherwise taken.
That's extremely talented and thoughtful afternoon talk show host Scott Sands of radio station WSPD in Toledo, Ohio, discussing the feelings, protests, violence, and ideological turmoil that has exploded onto the national scene in the aftermath of the grand jury's decision and the terribly painful Breonna Taylor death at the hands of a botched police action in which none of the three officers involved are being charged with murder. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison rap. The economy remains on the front burner of the national conversation due to COVID-19's devastating impact on both lives and livelihoods. Last week, we interviewed the morning host at KMZQ in Las Vegas about her personal bout with COVID-19. This week, we're presenting part two of that conversation with Heidi Harris, in which she discusses the economic impact of the pandemic on her city's economy and workers. What is your assessment of the public mood at this point?
I think the public mood is a little bit of a despair. I mean, not everybody's affected. There are some people I know who haven't lost, you know, they've got two career couples and they haven't lost either job and things like that. But Michael, I got to tell you, I come on the air every day and I still have a job, but I am so devastated for my town. And you come on the air, you don't want to be Debbie Downer. You know, you don't want to say, oh, well, this happened and more layoffs and this and that and the other. But I am heartbroken for my town because I used to entertain for a living, as you know, and I know what it's like to be a singer, musician, whatever. A lot of these gig workers have gotten nothing out of the state, which they were supposed to be getting. They've gotten nothing. The state's been, once again, run terribly, the unemployment system. And I'm devastated for people I know who built businesses for 15 or 20 years who are going to lose everything. And I think in another couple of months, you're going to see a lot more foreclosures. Haven't seen too much of that yet. Haven't seen too many tow trucks showing up to get the cars yet, but I've seen a little of it. In another few months, I think it's going to be just horrible because a lot of us were hoping that spring was going to be the great time to, you know, the conventions were going to come back. You know, the NAB Broadcasters Convention, which I'm sure you attend every year, has already been moved to next fall. It was supposed to be here in April, and that gets 100 and something thousand people. And so the problem that Vegas has is that 42 million people used to come here every year, many of them on planes. So what's happened is these hotels like Venetian and Wynn and Palazzo and these Bellagio, these nice hotels where the rooms are $500 a night and up, which I know is nothing in New York City, but for here that's a lot, they're designed to accommodate people who come here from out of the country or out of town who come for a convention. All these hotels that have been built in the last 30 years or so have been built on top of a lot of convention space. That's part of the hotel. And obviously, the expectation is that they will fill, you know, get the heads in the beds with the people in conventions. So if conventions don't come here because, A, they are worried about this year not coming because of all what's going on, or, B, 2 years from now, they're worried about the liability, potentially, of putting an employee on a plane who then gets COVID in Vegas, which you can't prove. They could have gotten it anywhere, right, in the airport, on the plane, you don't know. That's an issue. And if that doesn't happen and conventions don't come back for a couple of years, I don't see how this town sustains itself as far as the casino industry, certainly the bigger hotels. And what they've tried to do over the last couple of months is they've tried to drop the room rate so low, all they're bringing in is the Jerry Springer crowd. That's it. That's why we had fights and brawls, all kinds of things over Labor Day weekend, because we're bringing in a clientele that is not suited for a $500 a night room. And we're trying to attract them to get the heads in the beds, and that's been detrimental. And now the hotels are going, whoops, can't do that anymore. Right.
You know, you mentioned that $500 a night is nothing in New York. Well, New York hotels are down to like $100, $80, $90, $120 a night, fancy hotels. And you probably have heard that, you know, on the Upper West Side, some of the fancy hotels are housing homeless people, which has created an uproar among the residents. Many of the residents are extremely liberal in their voting habits, and they're really being tested now as to, you know, you get the picture. But now this is not just in Vegas. This is happening all around the country. The connection between tourism, hotels, services, food, entertainment, transportation. It's an amazing essay in how the economy works, where one thing is connected to another, to another, to another. And when you have massive problems, as we're having, the ripple effect touches everybody in one way or another. Yeah. It's fascinating and troubling.
It's true. We in Vegas, we can be so Vegas-centric at times and forget about the fact that there are so many other places like Hawaii, Orlando, you know, even Minneapolis. There was some story I saw a couple weeks ago about, you know, they had like the top 25 markets that had been hit by this, and we weren't even in the top 25. I was stunned at that. Some of the other markets that are completely dependent on tourism, like we are, certainly have been hit hard. But we tend to be, you know, one horse town to a large degree, and that makes it harder. But yeah, it's devastating for a lot of people, because the folks who work in restaurants and you know, singing lounges and things like that, they're living hand to mouth. Most of these people don't make that much money. A lot of them don't get benefits, and I know what that's like. And they, you know, they're not going to survive this long term. They're never going to catch up. They're running up their credit cards to stay afloat. They're maybe taking out home equity loans, whatever. Well, when you go back to work, if you're making the same money or less, which is what happened in 2010. Many of us saw so many cuts in, you know, the staff and whatnot. You're not going to ever catch up. And so here we go again. It's just depressing, because I don't want to come on the air and be depressing as a talk show host. I want to be positive, and I look for the positive stories whenever I can. Another hotel's opening, that's great news. Something else is happening, that's good news. So I try to sprinkle that in, but not be Pollyanna about it, because you've got to be real.
That's interesting you point that out. For the people in the talk radio business and people who are general communicators anyway, there is an area between being, you know, a Pollyanna and being a Debbie Downer, and that is having empathy, which is neither negative nor, you know, syrupy or fake positive. Is just giving people comfort and support. which I think is something that many folks in the communications business are coming to grips with right now. It is something that many people, especially in political news talk radio, haven't thought about. And now, it is challenging for some to be able to show sincere empathy in the course of their programs. Does that ring a bell with you?
No, that makes sense. It's not for me because I've done those jobs and I have so many friends who are in those occupations. So to me, it's not because I just see myself as a working person, a normal person. I don't see myself as a celebrity or anything. And I understand what it's like to, I also understand what it's like, and you know this because we've talked about this in my career. I know what it's like to be fired unexpectedly. And it's not easy. We've all gone through it, and it's very tough at times with people through no fault of their own, whatever. But so I completely understand what it's like, and you try to be a beacon and try to help them as best you can. Give out whatever information you can that's helpful, and just let them know that you do understand. You absolutely understand the situation. For example, I put on my Facebook page, my show page, Heidi Hare show page, a story about some waiter who was a waiter all these years, and now he's living in a tent or something. And, you know, some people put some things, well, he should have gotten more job skills years ago. And I go, hold on. And I got on there, and I always talk to my listeners about, you know, we interact a lot. And I said, wait a minute. I said, you don't understand how many people in this world live hand to mouth or month to month, and they don't want to do anything other than clean rooms or be a waiter. God bless them. God bless them. Everybody wanted to be a CEO, we'd be in big trouble. And I said, this is all they aspire to. There's nothing wrong with that. And they don't have a job, but it's not their fault. I said, come on, how about some sympathy here? You know? And they were like, yeah, I know. Well, okay, because I feel it. And I've actually had friends say, you know, you sound like you're really burdened with this at times, and I am. I'm burdened because my heart is broken for these people who are losing everything. It's just so sad. One of my entertainer friends in town, who used to be a headliner in Vegas and making some real serious money back in the day, hasn't worked since January, since New Year's Eve. And a lot of the guys and girls are doing videos on, they're doing, you know, Facebook Live concerts and things like that, just trying to keep their chops up, I guess. But it's sad. It's just, it breaks my heart because it's not necessary. And if they follow my plan, just open the casinos and let people decide whether or not they feel safe in a particular place. If they don't feel safe, they can leave. That's the way to do it. Experiment with it. Try it. See how it works. That's what I think.
That's our correspondent from Las Vegas, Nevada, the morning host of KMZQ Radio, Heidi Harris. Heidi's written two provocative and insightful books. One is called Don't Pat Me on the Head, Blowback, Setbacks, and Comebacks in Vegas Radio. And the other, Cocktail Waitress Wisdom, Life Lessons Learned While Carrying a Tray in Las Vegas. And they're both based upon her life experience. Check out her website, HeidiHarris.com. Coming up next, a conversation with Joe Thomas, the morning show host of WCHV in the city where a major chapter of the national conversation, demonstrations, counter-demonstrations, and violence got started just a bit over 3 years ago, Charlottesville, Virginia. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap.
Attention homeowners, spending more time around your house means you're putting more stress on major appliances that keep your home running. Like many Americans, a major breakdown could be very costly during these uncertain times. AC unit goes, that's $4,500. Water heater breaks, $1,500. When you own a home, it's always something. If you have a home warranty, those repairs could cost you nothing. A Home Service Club warranty pays for the repair or replacement of your home appliances and systems when they break down, even from normal wear and tear. For about $1 a day, you can cover your home appliances and systems. It's not a question of if they'll break down, it's when. If you call now, you'll get your first month free and $75 off your first year. Make home appliance repairs one less thing to worry about. Call 800-259-1604 now for your free quote, free first month, and $75 off your first year. 800-259-1604 now. That's 800-259-1604. Again, 800-259-1604.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. It was slightly more than 3 years ago that the demonstrations in Charlottesville, Virginia, sparked controversy and national headlines and served as a precursor for the turbulent times that have followed. Earlier this week, I engaged in a conversation with the program director and morning show host of WCHV in Charlottesville, Joe Thomas, that ran on his station where I was his guest on the phone, and now a segment of which is running on our program where he's my guest on the phone. Sort of a delayed simulcast from two different studio perspectives. We talked about a wide variety of contemporary issues.
Like in 2001, news and information radio, never mind discussion radio, has never been more important to the listeners, I think more so even than 2001, where they were just trying to find out what in the heck is going on. Now it's really, tell me the latest. What is, you know, on the horizon, treatments, inoculations, that kind of thing. And I'm reading about layoffs every time I turn around. And I said, yeah, how can that possibly be more people consuming talk radio and news radio and information radio than ever before? It was certainly for many years, and yet we're laying off people. We can't do that. We've got to find a way to survive.
There are a tremendous amount of disconnects in our society right now when it comes to economics, and they do apply to the talk radio medium, to the radio medium in general. There's not a ratio between how many readers you have or how many listeners you have and how much money you make. And there is a huge disconnect on a larger level between what's going on Wall Street and what's going on Main Street. And even though a tremendous number of Americans own stock, I think something like 15% of Americans own some kind of stock, as opposed to other statistics. I think that President Trump says 50% of Americans own stock. I'm not sure. When we judge the economy on the stock market, we're really not reflecting what the average person is facing who has a mortgage to pay, is either worried about their job, had a cutback in pay, or they've lost their job, they've been furloughed, they don't know if they're coming back, or if they're running a small business and it's been closed, or they're running a small business and restrictions are such that they're not doing as much traffic. There's a lot of pain out there, not just in the radio business and in the advertising business, but there's a lot of pain out there on Main Street America. And I don't see it being reflected in the way in which the statistics and the economic news is being presented to the American people. What do you think?
Well, I think absolutely. I think we need to see these closed down city streets, whether it be New York or Charlottesville, and say, listen, these are people, whether they're waitresses or chefs or newspaper delivery boys, that are not allowed to, in some cases by government order, to go to work. And you realize, like we did in 07, Michael, how fragile an economy that relies mostly on us buying things from each other is. All you need is somebody to grab onto their wallet just a little tighter, and it starts a tsunami at the other end of the wave it starts. And here it's never mind grab it a little tight. This is, we're stuffing the wallet under the bed and saying, I'm not going out for a while. And I laud the people who have come up with creative ways, whether it's the DoorDash people and the Uber Eats, but the restaurants that have tapped into that themselves and said, okay, well, we don't open the dining room, but let's see if we can't keep businesses going. We try to use our website and our on-air presence to let people know who's doing delivery and what's going on there. I almost wonder if we will still have a commerce when we come out of this, but it's going to look so radically different. It's going to take a while to figure out.
There's no question it's going to take a long time to figure out, and I'm not sure what the ultimate economic ramifications of this will be when things finally settle down. There's a lot of momentum going on just from habit, and you know, there are all type of conflicting economic forecasts, just as there are conflicting reports about how this whole COVID thing operates. The CDC just this past week went back on its new rules that were its old rules, where it's new rules and it's old rules, and they said they made a mistake. You know, it's, who do you believe about anything anymore?
Well, and
I think part of this, and I've tried to say this to my listeners as much as possible, is this is the case of something where, you know, we're watching the detectives as the investigation is going on. So it's very easy to look back and say, oh, well, we should have seen this, we should have seen that. But this is something we don't know. Now we're starting to see statistics about transmission ability. We have a fundraiser. We have, you know, the face mask is the new T-shirt, is what I call it, Michael. We have station logo face masks that we're raising money for the United Way with. They've been doing Herculean efforts, but you know, just stopping the spread from one another. Schools with plexiglass in between classroom desks so kids can be at least in the classroom again. Those kind of amendments show the creativity of people when you say, okay, it's in your spittle, we don't know how, but that's sort of how you also don't know you have it while you're giving it to other people. Okay, well, that's a pretty basic concept. We can work with that while you work on what's happening, you know, in the lab. I've often wondered what the American Revolution would have ended up like if talk radio had existed in that sort of, you know, play-by-play broadcasting. I don't know what Nathaniel Green is doing. I mean, Joe Cornwallis is kicking his tail all the way down the James River. He's going to be in Yorktown. Washington needs to fire him right now. I mean, we sometimes jump the gun on things just to be dramatic, I think.
Well, and also, when you say talk radio, what about just the digital era? What about, you know, social media, Facebook, Twitter, all of these things? Sometimes I have trouble wrapping my brain around how did the world work in the 1700s or the 1800s or even the 1950s when things were so slow. You wonder, you know, how did they even know they had a war? How did George Washington recruit an army? You know,
it doesn't take it a while.
Think about it. You know, our notion of a mass public, a mass appeal, a mass media is something that is very, very limited to the 20th century. That today we're in a fractionalized media, and as a result, we have a fractionalized culture. But because most of the people listening to this broadcast who are talk radio listeners, are used to there being a mass culture. Everybody knew the number one song. Everybody knew who won the Oscar for Best Actor. Everyone knew who the Vice President of the United States is. But today, it's all fractured, and we bemoan the loss of our national culture. However, if you look at history and you go back to the 19th century, and the further back you go, the more profound this is, there was no mass culture back then. The president would make a speech. It would take weeks for the transcriptions of it to make their way across the country. Every community not only had its own reality, they had their own time. It took the railroads to get everybody on the same clock. So this whole notion of a mass popular culture really is perhaps a very limited blip in terms of humanity's history. Kind of an interesting, you know, perspective.
Well, it also, I think it flies in the face of Americanism, to use the phrase, I think, more, you know, because Americanism is really that fractional, hey, this is what we do here, this is what life is like. I was just looking at something we were talking about, mass culture. You know, Patrick Henry, perhaps one of the most famous speeches of the American Revolution, 100 people in attendance.
That's amazing. You know, and that means 100 people experienced it. It wasn't on CNN that night. There was no on-demand replay of it, you know?
No.
No YouTube.
There's no share this button on it. There's no social media. But that's a profound moment in American history, and 100 people were in the room with Patrick Henry when he said it. And then they went out, and obviously people wrote the history of it. But I think the idea of infinite diversity from infinite combinations is something that we kind of fight with, and then we go back to, and we fight with, and we go back to, almost undulating as a society. Michael, you and I, kind of just been riding in a good stateroom on it. But I think the bigger problems are down where we see the statistics of COVID-19 impacting the Black community, the communities of color. But that's in many cases because the economic issues of a weakened manufacturing base, lack of job opportunities have impacted them hardest, and they have the jobs least likely to be able to work from home. There are also the people who can't afford to take 2 weeks off if they do come down with COVID-19. So, these are the issues that I think that maybe with talk radio, but certainly in our legislative bodies, we need to be discussing.
How has this impacted Charlottesville? If I were to walk down Main Street, what would it appear like compared to, say, 3 years ago? I mean, you guys were in the center of the news what seems like an eternity ago, but it still does comes back with the line, very fine people. That's, Charlottesville, very fine people. But tell me what's going on there.
Well, broadcasting to those very fine people, and I actually just did 2 hours on that, which I titled, "If You Only Share One Podcast All Year, Share These Two." And it's a treatise on things like President Trump's statement, there were very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville, or the tweet about the question, should we delay the elections, that was reported as a statement, not a question. Those sorts of things. But here in Charlottesville, it was a wake-up call economically. I would like to think I've been here 13 years, Michael, and I've been saying we need to do a better job of coming up with an economy beyond the university grounds. And everyone sort of shrugged it off and said, oh, please, the university will never go away. The university will always provide us economic opportunity. There will always be professors that need their dry cleaning done or sandwiches made for a seminar they're holding. And then we woke up one morning and we were in Danville, and the paper mill was gone, and there was nothing. And I'd like to think that once the existential emergency is over, we can address the idea that the men and women who live in Charlottesville aren't just here to clean up after the university students who come to Charlottesville for a few months every year, that we need to get back. We used to manufacture textiles here. I mean, Charlottesville's original existence was based on the fact that we have lots of sheep farms, and the shepherds would bring their wool to the river, and they would either refine it here in Charlottesville or send it raw down to Richmond to be turned into linen. And that was our original stock and trade before Peter Jefferson ever brought his kid Tom out here. Those kind of jobs, whether that's the one, but technology, batteries, computers. We have one of the top computer app companies in the world, Willow Tree Apps, here in Charlottesville, and the intellectual capital of the university. Those need to be drivers beyond just saying, hey, can I sell you a T-shirt?
Oh. Do you think that the future of the university, I don't mean the school in Charlottesville, but just in general, the concept of the college and the university, will be significantly changed in terms of its structure, its infrastructure, its impact, how it operates going forward after COVID-19?
Yes, without question.
How so?
I actually see it from both sides, both as a broadcaster in Charlottesville with the university and the parent of a Virginia Commonwealth University student who is, hates the idea of online classes, but has grudgingly admitted that there are some classes that work pretty well online. I think you're going to see much more hybrid teaching. A family friend is living right now in Boulder, Colorado, while attending the University of Virginia because he can. We have overseas students that are attending the University of Virginia but can't come back to the United States, but they can still take their classes. I think we need to deal with our infrastructure. I don't know how much G is left in 5G. We may need to get to work on 6G if we're going to do this much online. But I think the university and I think the educational process in general has changed for keeps.
That's an excerpt of a conversation I had this past week on WCHV Charlottesville, Virginia, with the station's morning host and program director, Joe Thomas. And that brings us to the conclusion of this latest installment of our show. This has been the Michael Harrison Wrap, looking back at this past week of Monday, September 21st through Friday, September 25th, 2020. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And that does it for this week's installment of The Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in association with Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2020, all rights reserved.